all sorts of third-party or second-channel backdoor negotiations, cultural engagement and displays of Iranian art that would come to American museums, because they wanted better relations. They wanted to break into the Iranian market. They wanted to have fewer limitations on their dealings with the Iranian oil industry.
Remember, it's important to realize that Carter ran on a foreign policy platform which had two elements. One is no arms sales to dictators, and two, human rights internationally. Well, it turns out that the Shah of Iran was the largest purchaser of American arms. So when Carter is talking about no arms sales to dictators, who the hell could he be talking about? And number two, international human rights, that was the time when huge numbers of organizations were protesting human rights violations in Iran. So the Shah of Iran heard this and said, that's me. This guy is talking about me. He's not talking about the King of Saudi Arabia. He's not talking about Ferdinand Marcos. He's talking about me. And so I thought I was in good with these Americans, and all of a sudden, this guy becomes president of the United States, and that's his deal with foreign policy. So now I'm really nervous.
As soon as Jimmy Carter took office, he expressed his willingness to meet with the Shah. In a meeting with President Carter, Ardashir Zahedi, Iranian ambassador to Washington, said the ties between Iran and the U.S. have never been so close and strong.
Iran was central to U.S. foreign policy globally. Iran and the Shah in particular were trusted as being staunch allies and force multipliers for the United States in a region that was considered to be both a bulwark in the fight against communism in the Cold War and a site of, huge tensions and conflict in its own right in the Middle East.
According to the National Census conducted in 1976, Iran had a population of about 33.5 million that year. A young country which the U.S. counted on for the stability of the Persian Gulf region, Iran was also a major oil supplier of Israel.
As the question of oil, oil goes everywhere. When a tanker is filled up, you really don't know the destination of it. It could go, as I said, to everywhere and as well to Israel.
The Iranian point for Israel was very important because it was a major pillar of its strategic conception. Then there was the issue of oil. Iran was a major oil supplier, of course, to Israel. There are other things they're doing together. So once the Shah fell, it required a major assessment of Israel's strategic position. And the same applied to the United States. I mean, the Shah was America's major ally in the Middle East for a very long time, and definitely since the late 60s when oil revenues started accumulating and Iran became an important player. Under Nixon, Iran became basically the predominant power there in the Nixon doctrine. He thought Iran could promote American interests in the Gulf. And afterwards, Iran was a major purchaser of American weapons. You had tens of thousands of Americans working in Iran. So Iran was basically the major pillar.
The first sign of disagreement between the Shah and the Carter administration popped up as the U.S. refused to sell aircraft to Iran by canceling the AWACS contract. In an interview with Business Week, the Shah said, Iran has a capacity to become a $10 billion market per annum for the U.S. artillery products. And if the U.S. refuses to sell arms to Iran, it will lose that opportunity.
And if there is any sharing of resources, well, then we can share many things with the United States.
As the news over the tension between Iran and the U.S. broke, the media in both countries began to adopt new attitudes towards each other. Meanwhile, the island of stability was undergoing massive changes in its underneath layers.
I don't want to go into details about these things because I have already expressed myself. It is impossible to get anywhere on dictation terms. We are still ready to discuss, as always, all these problems, but the solution of these problems cannot be one-sided, and that once again in the favor of the rich countries of the world.
On January 21st, 1977, Mahmoud Jafarian, the head of Rastakhiz, or Resurrection Party, said, "Imperialism is intertwined with Iranian blood, race, and culture." 2 years later, when Iran was plunged in revolution, Parviz Adl, the foreign ministry spokesman, called Iranians Shah worshippers. He also advised the Iranian people to keep the peace. The country was to be thrown into political turmoil, but the regime was not in the picture.
Unrest during the Shah's regime focused on a number of broad factors. I mean, first and foremost, the Shah was a dictator. There was not really any sharing of power after the Mossadegh era with anybody else. The Shah kept all power for himself. Any trappings of democracy that existed, like elections or political parties or anything, or independent newspapers, were just a sham. Iran was a dictatorship under the Shah. It was not highly repressive until the 1970s. I would say it was more like moderately repressive in the 50s and 60s. In the 1970s, it became highly repressive.
On February 3, 1977, 66 political prisoners were released from Qasr prison. All of them denied being tortured when in detention. This was part of their freedom deal. Ali Akbar Etemad, the head of Iran's nuclear energy organization, announced plans for constructing 20 nuclear power plants in the country with the help of foreign companies. And on June 4, 1977, it was announced that the world's largest nuclear reactor would be built in Bushehr in 4 years' time. Iran was clearing the decks for joining the International Nuclear Club. And on July 5, 1977, Iranian Prime Minister Amir Abbas Hoveidar declared, "The government cherishes freedom of expression and believes firmly in a diversity of opinions." The statement heralded seismic changes in the regime's behavior to come in line with Carter's human rights policy. On August 6, 1977, Hoveidar stepped down from his post as Prime Minister to be succeeded by Jamshid Amozgar. At the same time, Asadullah Alam handed in his resignation as Minister of Royal Court. Cancer had nearly struck him down. These fundamental changes in the structure of the regime left the Shah high and dry, especially in making decisions. The revolution was moving towards a climax. On August 13th, Dariush Homayoun, former Minister of Information and Tourism, said no one should fear to voice criticism. After all, he had been arrested and imprisoned on the Shah's orders during the period of adjustment in 1977.
Criticism was out of question. The Shah became megalomaniac in every field, including foreign policy.
Would you feel this personally when you would interact with him?
Well, you could see it in his body language, in his speeches, interviews with Americans. Some of his late interviews with Americans are really damaging to, were really damaging to him.
By mid-1977, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi had branded all his opponents as a bunch of terrorists. Talking to Kayhan newspaper on September 11, 1977, the Shah said, "We ask those who cry for freedom just one question. What kind of freedom do you want?" In September 1977, Ayatollah Talaghani's lawyers objected to his 10-year imprisonment. 3 years before, the Shah had announced in an interview that in his country, only communists were prosecuted. It was there that he coined the term Islamic Marxism. Meanwhile, the Shah was diagnosed with cancer and had to undergo intensive treatment. His ill health had cast a gloom over his future. Ruling the country had been a bumpy ride for the Shah. poor health and weakness of character had made the situation even worse. He also had a recurring nightmare of losing the US support. On the other hand, the gap between social classes was widening as never before. The country was on the brink of a great revolution. Suddenly, the price of oil began to soar. It was 1 minute to midnight for the crestfallen Shah to keep the throne for a longer time. By the end of 1977, Iran's oil exports exceeded 5.2 million barrels per day. And thanks to the windfall oil revenues, the country could import goods from 129 countries around the world.
You see, the oil is a very complicated business. We sell it to the oil companies. Now, there are so many different prices. A posted price, a realized price, a halfway price, a back-buy price, God knows what else. Then they are making these profits. In addition to this, well, I'm not criticizing, this is the sovereign right of each country, but I know some countries who levy taxes which are higher than we oil producing countries get by selling one barrel of oil.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Widespread voter anger was in evidence when American, Arab and Muslim leaders expanded a campaign launched recently against President Joe Biden over his handling of the conflict in Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Stay with us. Russia Today, RT Network, has covered this story and tells us more. Muslim American voters balked at the latest outreach effort by Joe Biden's administration, making it clear that the US president's support for the Israeli war effort in Gaza may imperil his re-election bid. At stake are several so-called swing states with large Muslim populations that helped propel Joe Biden to an electoral victory in the 2020 presidential election. Even small shifts in support from Arab Americans in such hotly contested states as Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Arizona could swing the 2024 election against the Democrat incumbent, who already faces an abandoned Biden movement in Michigan. Widespread voter anger was in evidence recently when Joe Biden's motorcade reportedly had to be rerouted during a campaign stop in Michigan because Arab Americans held a demonstration to voice their anger over the heavy civilian casualties in Gaza. While waving Palestinian flags, the protesters chanted, "Genocide Joe has got to go." Back in Washington, many of the Palestinian Americans invited to a meeting to discuss the Israel-Hamas war with Secretary of State Antony Blinken declined to attend. Explaining their decision to snub Secretary of State Antony Blinken, some of the invited guests said in a statement, "We do not know what more Secretary Blinken or President Biden need to hear or see to compel them to end their complicity in this genocide." Pro-Palestinian protesters have also camped outside Antony Blinken's home in recent days to press for a change in policy. Dr. Tariq Haddad, a Virginia cardiologist who declined to attend recent meeting at the U.S. State Department, told Antony Blinken in a letter that he could not face him after the administration's policies led to the deaths of 80 of his family members in Gaza. Dr. Tariq Haddad wrote, "The more I thought about this meeting, the more I could not emotionally bring myself to look you in the eyes, Secretary Blinken, knowing you and President Biden have knowingly contributed to the suffering and murder of so many members of my family, the homelessness and dispossession of 2 million Palestinians of Gaza, and the famine that has befallen my remaining family members." According to local health authorities, tens of thousands of innocent Gazans have been massacred since the war began on 7th of October, and the United Nations has reported that nearly 600,000 people in the besieged Gaza Strip are starving. The Biden administration has approved 2 emergency arms sales to Israel, bypassing congressional authority, and has rejected calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. At the same time, President Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken claim that they have urged Israeli leaders to minimize civilian casualties in Gaza and allow more humanitarian aid trucks to enter Gaza. A Quinnipiac University opinion poll released recently showed that only 34% of U.S. voters approve of Joe Biden's handling of the crisis in Gaza. An earlier opinion poll by CBS News found that President Biden's support for Israel was alienating at least one-third of Democratic voters in America. National broadcaster CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. Arab leaders in Michigan elected to forgo a scheduled meeting with President Joe Biden's campaign manager, Julie Chavez Rodriguez, in Dearborn, Michigan, recently. This decision comes amidst heightened tensions stemming from the Israeli war in Gaza, which has elicited widespread anger among voters in Michigan. A group of stakeholders within the community, including Wayne County Executive Assad Turf, cancelled the meeting, citing dissatisfaction with President Joe Biden's handling of the Israeli war in the Gaza Strip. Other prominent figures, including Dearborn's mayor, Abdullah Hamoud, also declined the invitation, asserting that the timing was inappropriate for electoral discussions. The mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, Abdullah Hamoud, expressed, "For us, you have to have that conversation with policymakers, those who are actually influencing decision-making. That is not campaign staff. It's actually dehumanizing to send campaign staff to ask us what would it take to earn your support in November when you have an active genocide that is being funded and supported and defended by the current administration." Khaled Tourani, chairman of the abandoned Biden campaign in Michigan, dismissed any attempts by the Biden administration to regain support from Arab American voters, labeling it as futile. Local Palestinian activist Lexis Zaidan echoed similar sentiments, rejecting the invite and emphasizing the newfound political significance of the Arab American and Muslim vote. Lexis Zaidan says, "They now see us as a threat and they know they can't win in elections without us. State Representative Al-Abbas Farhat, a member of the Democratic Party, emphasized that the issue transcends politics, advocating for a ceasefire as the primary focus of any dialogue. Emphasizing the need for immediate action to address the ongoing crisis, Al-Abbas Farhat asserted, "This isn't a political issue, the solution is simple. It's been laid out for nearly 4 months." CBS News Detroit reached out to the Biden campaign for comment. However, the Biden campaign has not responded. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered this same story. American Arab and Muslim leaders expanded a campaign launched recently against President Joe Biden over his handling of the Israeli war in Gaza. Abandon Biden campaign was first launched by Muslim leaders from Michigan, Minnesota, Arizona, Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. The recent plan to actively campaign against Joe Biden in all 50 U.S. states was announced in Chicago, Illinois, at the end of a national convention organized by the Muslim American Society and the Islamic Circle of North America. The leaders intend to guarantee Joe Biden's loss in the upcoming 2024 election over his refusal to call for a ceasefire in Gaza, where Israeli attacks have massacred tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians. The campaign organizers say on their website, "President Biden's abandoning of Muslim Americans compels Muslim leaders to abandon Biden." Speaking at a press conference during the announcement of the nationwide plan, Hassan Abdel Salam, the spokesperson for the campaign, stated, "The idea here is that we will actively campaign against and ensure that Joe Biden loses his 2024 election." Hassan Abdel Salam, the spokesperson for the campaign, added, "The president betrayed us because he violated the value of dignity and life. What's the point of voting for you when you deny 2.2 million people in Gaza their water?" Council on American Islamic Relations CARE Minnesota Representative Jaylani Hussein, for his part, said, "The organization demands President Biden to be sensitive and consistent regarding Gaza." During his interview with Anadolu News Agency, Edward Ahmed Mitchell, the Council on American Islamic Relations National Deputy Executive Director, said, "There is intense disappointment among Muslim Americans regarding President Biden's policy on Israel and Palestine, especially the ongoing war in Gaza." The civil rights attorney, Edward Ahmed Mitchell, added, "It is very clear to everyone that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not accidentally killing civilians whilst targeting resistance fighters. He is deliberately targeting Palestinian civilians."
Welcome back to Aperture. Over the past 50 years, the average global temperature has increased at the fastest rate in recorded history. Scientists agree that the Earth's rising temperatures are fueling longer and hotter heat waves, more frequent droughts, heavier rainfall, and more powerful hurricanes. The impacts of global warming are being felt across the globe. And it could speed up if we keep burning fossil fuels at our current pace. But it's not just global warming. other forms of pollution are also destroying the Earth. Now, many experts agree that environmental, economic, and health consequences are likely to occur if current trends continue. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the documentary.
We are a family, the Earth itself, and the humans that live on this planet, who can have a positive or negative interaction with each other. If we do negative things, nature will respond negatively.
Unfortunately, when we collectively use more and produce more, we see this as welfare. Anywhere in the world, if the production of automobiles, cement, or electricity increases, officials of that country take pride in it. For instance, they say we've been able to boost steel production by 10%.
Our main priority now is to cap production.
They would never come and say that we've cut production because the Earth is sick, it has a problem, that this year we've cut our production, we've cut cement, we've cut steel in order to cause less harm to the Earth. We haven't yet reached that stage.
Today, we hardly consider the future in our decisions. I can frankly say that we never think about the future.
The sky that you look upon, the air that you breathe, is your father. The planet you live on is your mother.
We failed to take into consideration the Earth's biological capacity, and this is the number one reason for the disaster we're now facing.
The polar bear, the ruler of the Arctic. There are 25,000 of them left in the world. They're on the verge of extinction. Animals need ice for hunting seals and other prey, but the Arctic is melting.
Our water resources are being destroyed. Natural ice caps, which are the main source of sweet drinking water for billions of people, are melting. These are issues that will powerfully affect the future of mankind.
Everyone here is praying for more rain, but is it already too late?
Lack of water will be the main problem for mankind in the future.
It certainly looks like a crisis after the worst drought in 80 years in the state of São Paulo. Reservoirs have reached rock bottom, and everyone's hoping the rainy season will bring a miracle.
With global warming, we're concerned about the future of the Earth's environment and worried about the continued life of human beings. We're concerned about environmental adversities that could happen to the Earth. For example, the rise of international waters, melting of polar ice caps, and extinction of many animal species.
Look, with the predicted temperature changes, all polar ice caps are melting. Why? Why is all this happening? Because the temperature is rising, and so Q, or heat energy, is increasing. The temperature on Earth is rising. When a place like Alaska and cold climate regions are going down, well, this temperature difference is being narrowed. What will happen if the temperature difference narrows? Distances are being narrowed. So that means depth is being added to. When it becomes deeper, it means we're moving into it.
We'll be right back.
Due to the destruction we're causing to the planet, polar ice caps will melt in no time and water levels will rise. Then you'll see how many cities will be totally inundated, and this will lead to great expense and loss for humans. How many refugees will we have? What amount of humanitarian aid would be required for those inundated countries and to accommodate their people?
I am thinking about all the suffering you have caused us.
It's obvious that at some level we abuse the Earth to make money, but then we have to spend it, and the spending will probably increase.
I am trapped in a nightmare. I am trapped in this nightmare. I hope I wake up soon. This catastrophe is more than I can bear. But I am a forgiving mother. I cannot stand that my children are vanishing.
The main discussion point here is, to what extent are we endangering the balance of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere?
This is the result of years of indifference toward the rise of fuel consumption by Earth's inhabitants, using fossil fuels and extracting amounts of carbon from the depths of the Earth and emitting it out into our atmosphere, with the oceans and water's low capacity in absorbing it.
Countries that produce oil and gas highly depend on oil revenues for their income. Well, if we discuss cutting emissions, that will mean reducing the production of fossil fuels, and that could somehow affect their income in the future. We humans, for our own interests, have been indifferent toward the Earth by gradually increasing the use of heating devices for transportation, as in cars, or fossil fuels that are used in industries, petrochemical refineries, powerhouses, and household fuels, and so on.
این محصول بی‌توجهی ما به حال زمین بوده.
We all breathe the same air. There may be less pollution in one place and more in another, but its effect on the environment can be hazardous for us all.
برای همه ما میتونه زیانبار و زیانبخش باشه.
Used to be so good, but my children started to forget about me. They started to only think about themselves and forgot about their mother. I don't quite understand why greed has taken such a hold of you. My children have brought disorder to this world.
We will see many people lose their habitats due to rising seawater levels in the future.
Consider the chain of islands that make up the Maldives.
which are only 1.2 meters above sea level at most. The country will lose a large portion of its land with the minutest rise in open water levels. Residential areas will be destroyed.
Many people will be unable to continue living in their own countries due to drought and lack of water.
You pointed out to wars being fought in the future over water. Unfortunately, I have to say that these wars have already started. The future is now.
Since entering the 21st century, even in our own Western region, there have been serious challenges over water resources.
So discussions about war and the competition for having access to water resources have already begun. It may not be that serious now, but be aware of its complications.
A large number of people will have to be relocated because their cities will become uninhabitable.
These people will migrate to places across the world, but these other areas do not have a high capacity either. It will be one of mankind's major problems in the future.
What does it all mean? It will mean high expenses for human living, something we never thought about. We never thought that a big city could ever become uninhabitable, a city with millions of residents, but it's happening.
The people I see, these are people, Paula, let me explain, who are people with limited resources. These are people who did not have the wherewithal to get out of town. They didn't have cars. There's no way they could pay for a hotel room. They stayed in their houses because they had to. And then the water came up, and I'm sure there were elderly here, there were infirm here. It's just horrific.
پیش‌بینی میشه که طی 15 سال آینده بر اساس بهترین برآوردهای
Based on UN estimations, it's predicted that within the next 15 years at most, between 80 and 90 million people will be displaced from small countries that are made up of chains of islands due to global warming and climate change. Then we won't be dealing with migrants and asylum seekers displaced by war and conflict. We will have migrants fleeing environmental disasters as well. So we need to make people around the world more aware of this eventuation and find a solution for it.
در جامعه جهانی باید با این ادبیات بیشتر خودمون رو مانوس بکنیم و براش تدبیر بیاندیشیم.
If I make a mistake here and go to jail, my kids and family will live the effects. I've done something wrong, but my child will feel its effects. If I make a mistake as a member of the global community, that mistake affects the whole. One multiplied by 1,000. One is a small figure. One is a small figure, but it's multiplied by 1,000. What does it equal? It equals 1,000. We have an index called M for mistake, which is a huge figure collectively. It's the mass of the entire planet. It's not at all a small figure. Now, even if you have an extremely small figure, you're multiplying it by a very large number. One multiplied by 1,000 equals 1,000. The one turned into 1,000. Two multiplied by 1,000 equals 2,000. Three multiplied by 1,000 equals 3,000. 0.5 multiplied by 1,000 equals 500. So we should be aware of what we're doing.
که داریم چه میکنیم؟
The
Earth is also making all efforts to somehow balance all the noise and demands we're imposing on it. However, our power, mankind's destructive power, is now seemingly taking the upper hand over the Earth's ability to regenerate itself.
Anyways, we should know that if the doors to the future open in this way, it will lead to a grave crisis.
Sustainable argument. I think about climate change and this disaster.
The components of social welfare need to be changed. The developing world should no longer be using the same criteria the developed world has defined as welfare for its people and follow their footsteps.
If we take an overall look, I think any project, any move, any industrialization, any process or any technology should calculate the temperature rise on the Earth in proportion with the delta T quotient.
Finally, humans can go on living for a week or two without food and a few days without water, but without air, we can't but survive for a minute. It is the most vital of anything the Earth's atmosphere has provided us with. We're using it, but on the other hand, we're destroying it, badly and with high cost. We place it into a poorly manufactured man-made combustion device and receive toxic chemicals on the other side, which remains. It remains and moves around. And the Earth has no way to get rid of some of these toxic chemicals we've produced.
The economy has limited all activities to itself, and those who speak about the impact on the environment and the earth just talk and hold summits, but practically it's almost useless.
Concern. Just concern. What does that mean? What does being concerned mean? Static concern is meaningless. Concern should be dynamic. If you're concerned, you should do something to reduce that concern. That's a dynamic solution, not a static one. A static solution just adds to your concern and accumulates and is useless. Concern must be dynamic. What does dynamic mean? It means you must seek a real solution for it. It means you need to have a program.
I believe that if we carry on like this, making the Earth sick and failing to do anything about this sickness, we'll be deeply ashamed in front of our next generations. They've had no role in bringing about this situation, yet they have to bear the consequences. Consequences that are getting worse by the day. So I can't do anything but apologize to the next generation who might be watching this film for the disasters that my generation is causing the environment and the earth.
I don't understand why. My children are destroying the one and only home that they have. As my children, they have closed their eyes to the facts. Don't use your planet in the wrong way. We are a part of you, not separated from you.
The Earth has been stable and balanced due to its ecosystem. It carried on with its life way before we ever came along and started hurting and destroying it. Finally, just like a pendulum will do, if you place it out of balance, it will try to balance itself, reach its lowest energy level, and become balanced.
The Earth is our mother. It's beautiful, it's a creator, it's merciful, and we in return are being very bad children.
Well, it's perfectly true that every single one of us citizens of the Earth must do our share to reduce pollution. But to curb global warming and avoid its dire consequences, the countries most responsible must make an effort. The U.S. has caused more global warming than any other country. Research shows that from 1850 to the year 2011, the United States, a single country, produced 27% of the total carbon dioxide emissions of the world. No other single country was even close. Indeed, the U.S. even outdistanced all the nations of the European Union combined. Well, that's a wrap for this week, but join me again next week here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
South Africa's Minister of International Relations, Naledi Pandor, has warned that all states have a legal obligation to uphold the provisional measures ordered by the ICJ in regard to the Zionist regime's actions in Gaza, adding that failure to do so is complicity in the crimes of genocide. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Pandor said recently, despite its claims, these orders are binding upon Israel. It has to immediately implement these provisional measures to prevent a further increase of its human rights violations. She was speaking at a public report back session on the case at a Cape Town mosque. Pandor explained, in fact, all states now have a legal obligation to ensure respect for the provisional measures as well as ensure that they are not complicit in the genocide. She added, essentially, if the case proceeds as we anticipate, and it is found that Israel committed genocide, all those who were complicit are as guilty as Israel. On January 26, the International Court of Justice ordered the Zionist regime to adopt 6 provisional measures to ensure it, inter alia, takes all measures within its power to prevent genocide. South Africa brought the case to the World Court in December, accusing the child killer regime of Israel of committing the crime of genocide in Gaza in violation of the 1948 Genocide Convention, which both countries are party to. Minister Pandor said, there are many who are seeking to undermine these orders, for example, the attempt to redefine it so that the killings continue. Some Western governments immediately said, we hear the judgment, but they didn't order a ceasefire. We can say this only as aiding and abetting. The minister said, this order for us is a win for international law and for the Genocide Convention, which embodies the solemn pledge to prevent the crime of genocide and hold those responsible to account. She continued that it is truly tragic that the Genocide Convention, which was drafted in Europe, that it is the very people who then moved to Palestine who are offending this convention. Minister Pandor stressed that despite the Zionist regime's attempts to block the ICJ from making this order, and in its failed attempt to spin the judgment itself as a victory for them, Israel stands facing the international community and peoples of the world. It stands having failed to deflect attention from its crimes or justify its unfolding genocide. It is now naked to the world for the first time. She explained that for the first time in 75 years, Israel is being held accountable by an institution and by the global community. The minister impressed upon the audience that although we have won our freedom from the oppression of apartheid, it is our duty to seek that freedom for all humanity, for all who are oppressed. This is our duty and we must carry it out. Before filing a case against the Zionist regime at the ICJ, South Africa also referred Israel to the International Criminal Court for an investigation into alleged war crimes committed in its ongoing assault to the Gaza Strip. A few other countries joined South Africa in that referral. Minister Pandor said South Africa took those actions in an attempt to save lives, for justice, peace, and for an end to violent occupation. She emphasized that during the struggle against apartheid, the international community joined in developing a concept some of us forget called international solidarity. While we waged a mighty struggle against apartheid, our leaders went from country to country across the world and asked for support, she explained. The fabricated regime of Israel is being accused of committing genocide in Gaza. According to Gaza's Ministry of Health, at least 27,478 Palestinians have been martyred and 66,837 wounded in the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza starting on October 7th. Moreover, at least 8,000 people are unaccounted for, presumed dead under the rubble of their homes throughout the Gaza Strip. Palestinian and international estimates say that the majority of those martyred or wounded are women and children. The Zionist regime's aggression has also resulted in the forceful displacement of nearly 2 million people from all the Gaza Strip, with the vast majority of the displaced forced to the densely crowded southern city of Rafah near the border with Egypt in what has become Palestine's largest mass exodus since 1948 Nakba.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 19th, 2010. Each year, the presence of millions of people in the 22nd Behmen demonstrations shows that the revolution and the Islamic Republic rely on the religious faith of the people. This is the main reason why the enemies are unable to undermine the Islamic Republic. The opponents of the Islamic Republic are terrified when they see the massive participation of the people in various demonstrations held in the country. In order to mask this solidarity with the help of their agents, the enemies pretend in their propaganda that the people are suffering from discord. The 22nd of Behmen is a national wealth and it belongs to the Iranian nation, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, and the martyrs. The enemy is trying to undermine this great national wealth. Therefore, we must be present on the scene with all our power and move ahead thoughtfully.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
January 24th, 1990. The 22nd of Behmen is the real Eid of our nation. Imam Khomeini showed us the way to live free, to become perfect, to live life in a way that satisfies God and is required in Islam, to truly construct life and to avoid compliance with anti-Islamic powers. To us, these are the lessons of Behmen 22. The 22nd of Behmen is the real Eid of our nation. Behmen 22 is like Eid al-Fitr for our nation in which the nation put an end to a difficult fasting period when our nation was deprived of spiritual and material nourishment. The 22nd of Behmen is like Eid al-Adha because it was on that day that our nation sacrificed their Ismails, their sons. The 22nd of Behmen is like Eid al-Ghadir because it was on that day that the blessings of the Wilayat and completion of the divine blessings became a reality and an external realization for the Iranian nation. The authorities in charge of the Fajr celebrations should, as far as they can, make people aware of the truth of this 10-day celebration by organizing good, varied, rich and meaningful programs. February 3rd, 2012. The presence of the people has made the sapling of the Islamic Revolution grow bigger. The holy 10-day Fajr celebrations have already started. During these celebrations, two things are necessary for us and people like us. First, we need to be thankful to God. We bow to God with complete humility for bestowing this blessing on the Iranian nation. This great movement, this great achievement, this historic movement was carried out by the Iranian nation under the leadership of our magnanimous Imam. The Islamic Republic was established. The Iranian nation started its movement towards God, towards divine goals, towards divine values.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.